It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrich. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, what would it take to get more dads in the U.S. to take paternity leave? We'll talk to an economics professor who says new research shows a possible solution. First, environmental groups are celebrating a pair of recent state Supreme Court rulings that they say will help protect Wisconsin water. Last week, the court ruled that the Department of Natural Resources has the power to place permit restrictions on high-capacity water wells and large-scale farms. At the center of both cases was a 2011 state law that lays out what state agencies are required or allowed to do. It's known as Act 21. Basically, it says those agencies can only do something if certain statutes or rules explicitly grant that authority. Industry groups argued that Act 21 blocked the DNR from imposing conditions on large livestock farms and from considering wider effects of high-capacity wells. The court ruled that protecting the state's waters, though, is still allowed under the Act. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should the DNR have wider powers to protect water, or do you think that that power should be more limited? What do you think about these Supreme Court decisions? Did they get it right or wrong? Will this clarification of the DNR's power better protect Wisconsin waters, or will it hurt business? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. In just a bit, we'll hear from a guest who's disappointed with the Supreme Court's decisions. First, Evan Feinauer is a staff attorney at Clean Wisconsin, which helped bring these two cases to the court. Evan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Well, as I just laid out a lot of legal twists and turns here, big picture though, Evan, what is your reaction to these Supreme Court rulings and what it means for the state?
Well, to be honest, my reaction to seeing these rulings was relief, because we put years and years of work into these cases, myself and our partners, which include Midwest Environmental Advocates in the Farm case and Pleasant Lake Management District in the Wells case. And we knew that winning these cases would be extremely important for protecting the state's waters going forward. And at the same time, that losing these cases could have ushered in a really problematic interpretation of law that could have limited the ability of the Department of Natural Resources and other state agencies as well to do the jobs that they need to do to protect people in this state.
Yeah, in just a minute, I want to dig into some of the specifics on what each of these cases involved. But as you just mentioned, this is also a sign for the future. What does this mean for future water regulation by the DNR here in Wisconsin?
Well, at least in the context of these two cases, it means they can go forward in using the tools that we felt that they always had. So in the context of high capacity wells, they can do the analysis that's required by the state constitution to make sure that high capacity wells aren't destroying or harming or impairing surface waters, your lakes, your rivers, your streams. And in the context of farms, it means DNR now has access to the tools that, again, we felt that they should have been using this whole time to have these large farms that spread a tremendous amount of manure on the ground investigate where is the manure causing groundwater contamination and potentially putting caps on the amount of manure that can be produced at these facilities. And this is really important to emphasize. This is about DNR having the ability to use these tools to limit impacts where the facts on the ground and the science support using them. This isn't a one size fits all. This isn't a DNR must do this in all cases. This is about them just having the ability to do it where appropriate.
Now, we've got this Act 21 law I mentioned going back about 10 years now. The idea is, as I understand it, we don't want to give agencies like the DNR too much authority to kind of wing it and apply rules beyond what's intended by statute or by the rulemaking process. The concern from, say, business or farming groups is maybe this gives the DNR too much power to step in beyond the intent of the legislature, of laws we've passed. What do you say to that concern?
Well, so a couple of things there. I mean, I'm a lawyer, so when I want to know what a law says, I look at what the law says. I look at the text on the page. And it says here that DNR has to have explicit authority if, for example, as relevant to these cases, they want to include conditions in a permit. So that means I then go to the statutes the legislature passed sometimes years ago, decades ago, saying, DNR, please do this, or you can do that. And if those statutes say that they can do these things, then they can do them. It's explicit. And in these cases, the court agreed with us that those statutes supply DNR with the relevant authority here. So it isn't so much about, did the legislature try to stop DNR from doing this? They're the ones who passed the laws in the first place that the Supreme Court agreed with us authorized DNR to do these things. So it isn't sort of the legislature versus the DNR. It's what the legislature says now versus maybe what it said before. And do these laws really speak to each other in that way? I'm a little skeptical about that. At the end of the day, we felt that they were pushing an extreme interpretation of this law that would have actually hindered the ability of DNR to do the things that the legislature had told it to do. So, for example, DNR is required to put conditions in permits that assure compliance with water quality standards. So we thought that that authorized DNR to require these large farms to monitor to see where their practices might be causing contamination and where they aren't causing contamination, which is also useful to know. To me, that was pretty clear cut. The Supreme Court agreed.
Talking to Evan Feinauer, staff attorney at Clean Wisconsin, looking at a pair of state Supreme Court rulings saying the DNR does have the ability, the power, the authority to set conditions on certain kind of permits. The particular cases here involved large-scale animal farms and high-capacity water wells. Let's take a look at each of those a little more in-depth, Evan, in turn. You were just mentioning watching for water quality around these large livestock farms. What kind of conditions, a little more specifically, can the DNR put on that permit for that farm?
Well, there are a lot of conditions that they have been putting in place the whole time. Mostly these relate to how a farm stores its manure and then how it spreads it on the surface, because that, of course, is a big part of the problem. You have a large amount of manure in a relatively small space. And in places like Northeast Wisconsin, where the geology is such, it can be really sensitive, meaning you get a big storm, you got runoff, you can have contaminated well water, you know, just later that day. It can happen that fast. And so one of the things that we think that they should be doing is just a little bit more investigation, a little bit more monitoring to determine a little bit about the where, when, and how much this contamination is occurring, because that's potentially going to allow DNR to craft additional solutions so that we can get to where we want. Where I think we all want to get, which is people have access to clean drinking water as much as is humanly possible, while understanding that these farms are going to produce this manure and they need to do something with it. So it's about intelligently and sustainably managing what we do with that manure. And in order to do that, we need to know sort of where the problems are. And so monitoring for contamination is really just common sense in that regard. And the court agreed.
That was one of the cases. The other had to do with high-capacity water wells. These are often used for the other kind of agriculture, growing crops here we're talking about. And there's been a long-running issue of whether, if I'm a farmer, I apply to have a high-capacity well or to change my permit. Can the DNR consider how many of these wells, how much drawdown of water in an area there is? Can you talk about this case a little more?
Yeah, so to your point, there's been a little bit of a back and forth in terms of the agency's stance on this particular issue, which to my mind and probably to the mind of a lot of the farmers is unfortunate because, you know, it creates this uncertainty that hopefully with this court ruling now has been put to bed. But the bottom line here is that under the state constitution, DNR has an obligation to check to make sure that these wells aren't hurting what are known as public trust waters. These are surface waters that are deemed navigable. So if a high capacity well that's used for irrigation is drawing down groundwater in such a way that it's causing, say, a nice trout stream to no longer be such a nice trout stream, DNR can and should take that into account and say, well, can you move this well? Can you pump a little bit less water? Could you dig a deeper well into a deeper aquifer? What are the options that you have so that we can allow you to get the water you need for your crops while also protecting these resources? Which under the state constitution, it's one of the great things about this state is that the state constitution enshrines that all of these waters, they don't belong to any private individuals or companies. They belong to all of us, and the state merely holds them in trust for all of us to use and enjoy. So this isn't about who has a right to the water. It's all of our water, and we're just trying to get to a place where we can sustainably manage it for all these various uses rather than it being overconsumed for short-term goals, reasonable and totally legitimate as they are.
So these are two big cases, as you say, you've been working on for quite a while, one on these large-scale livestock farms, one on high-capacity wells. Are there other water-related disputes in the legal system now that you have your eye on?
Yeah, of course. And it would be hard not to think about how these rulings might affect some of those other cases. In particular, we've seen arguments centering on Act 21, which you explained to your listeners earlier, as this 2011 law, As they relate to things like DNR's attempts to address PFAS contamination, which you know, hopefully your listeners are familiar with those stories around the state, and so you could see this emerging there. But you know, most of my work relates to water, and I'm focused on issues related to lead in drinking water, to wetlands protections. It runs the whole gamut, and that's because we got a lot of water resources in this state, and we need to keep the eye on the ball and make sure we're protecting them, so that my daughter and her children and future generations down the line can enjoy these things like we have growing up here.
Evan, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Evan Feinauer is a staff attorney with Clean Wisconsin. We talked to him about two recent state Supreme Court rulings that affirm that the DNR can restrict or deny permits for factory farms and high capacity wells. After the break, we'll hear from a group that's worried about the impact of those decisions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about these rulings we've been talking about from the state Supreme Court? Do you think the DNR should have this kind of authority to put these conditions on permits for large-scale livestock farms, for high-capacity wells? Are there other water-related issues that you hope or fear that this will impact? You can call in at 800-642-1234. And if you're in one of the communities in the state where this issue is a big deal, love to hear from you. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about what the State Department of Natural Resources can and can't do to regulate water after a pair of big state Supreme Court rulings last week. In short, the justices ruled that the DNR has the authority to place permit restrictions on high-capacity wells and large-scale livestock farms. Industry groups, including our next guest, say a law passed in 2011 should limit those actions because it doesn't explicitly say the DNR always has that authority. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let us know what you think about these Supreme Court rulings, what they mean for environmental protection and business development here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Scott Manley is Executive Vice President of Government Relations for Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. Scott, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Big picture, Scott, your reaction to this pair of Supreme Court rulings.
Well, of course, we think the court got it wrong. We think that they substituted their own political will for the letter of the law as enacted by the people through their legislature. So it's really disappointing, and I think that had the justices that voted for the majority opinion really thought this through, they would have come to the conclusion that they have opened up a Pandora's box as it relates to regulation in this state. And this, you know, the ramifications of this decision could go way beyond high capacity wells. They basically said if agencies have any authority at all, from the legislature, that's enough to regulate, and they can regulate however they want. And that's just not the way we do things in a democracy. We make law by passing bills through the legislature. And the legislature is elected and are accountable to the people. And if the people don't like the laws that the legislature enacts, they can vote them out. But what the Supreme Court said last week was, you know what, we're just going to let the unelected bureaucrats make all of the decisions in this state. And if you don't like it, well, there's very little you can do about it because the bureaucrats aren't elected and they really are answer to no one and are accountable to no one. So the decision last week was really a loss for democracy and very much a win for uncontrolled, unfettered bureaucratic regulation.
Could a legislature now or in the future, along with the governor, change that? I mean, they could go in and say, you know what? No, we don't want high capacity wells regulated in this way. Specifically, we're passing a law to prevent the DNR doing it. That isn't precluded by this decision, is it?
It's not precluded. But in fact, the Act 21, 2011 Act 21, was itself in response to a legislative enactment in response to a Supreme Court decision that the legislature thought the court had misinterpreted the law. So they passed Act 21 and said, no, this is the way agencies' authority operates. And the court got it wrong again. It's sort of like you know, what does the legislature really need to tell the court in order for them to understand that the Constitution vests the authority for making laws in the elected legislature, not in the unelected bureaucracy. So, yes, I mean, it's a long way of saying, yes, you're right. They could pass something, and we'll certainly encourage them to do that, because we do think it's important that lawmaking and decision making rests with elected officials who are accountable to voters. But it's just, you know, a little bit frustrating because, you know, the court could do what they did last week and just completely ignore the law and sort of make it up as they go, as they want to see it.
What kind of specific concerns do you have about what this could mean for, say, a future livestock application to the state or a high-capacity well application?
Well, I think the concern is that because of the nature of the dairy industry and, you know, the fact that we have lost so many dairy farms in the state, it's very difficult to remain competitive unless you scale up, meaning that you add additional animals to your operation. Then you can achieve an economy of scale that maybe gives you a fighting chance to survive. So, you know, in many respects, the future of the dairy industry in this state is about family farms combining together to sort of combine forces and have a larger scale operation. And this decision last week said, We're gonna let the DNR decide how big farms should be, not the economy, not the free market. We're just gonna let unelected bureaucrats decide, and that could be a death knell for small and medium sized farms that are trying to scale up and try and stay afloat. So it's very concerning, and it's even more concerning that the legislature never gave the DNR the authority to decide how big farms should be. They did give the legislature the authority to say, here's the environmental standards that we want you to meet if you're going to be if you're going to be a dairy farm, for example. And then and we support that, and we support having farms and all types of businesses to be accountable to environmental regulation. But when we get into the business of saying we're going to let unelected bureaucrats decide how many cows you get to have, even, you know, regardless of environmental impacts, that's just wrong. That's something the legislature never gave the agency the authority to do. And it's frankly sort of amazing that the Supreme Court somehow decided that that's what the law should be.
But if they are empowered to protect water quality and they come to a finding that, I don't know, X number of cows per acre, I don't know what the exact sort of standard is, has a bad impact on the environment, wouldn't that fit their, I don't know, their mission?
But there's so many ways that you can control environmental impacts aside from just saying you don't get to have cows. I mean, it would be difficult to imagine a more sort of big brother government command and control situation than saying it's not enough just to have environmental standards that you're required to follow. We're now going to tell you how to run your business, even if it means you can't be profitable doing so. The irony is that study after study shows that you're going to have better environmental compliance the more financial resources a business has. And this Supreme Court decision stands for the proposition that we're going to give DNR the authority to limit how many cows can be on a farm, thereby making farms less profitable and making it more difficult for them to achieve environmental compliance. So I think it's, listening to the speaker that you had just before me, I think the irony is that this court decision is going to make it harder to for agriculture to maintain better water quality in our state.
talking to Scott Manley from Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce about two recent state Supreme Court decisions on the DNR, their ability to regulate farms and high-capacity wells for water quality issues. Let's bring on a caller now. Mike is with us in Rusk County. Mike, hello.
I'm going to slightly modify my comment based on the WMC gentleman that just spoke. I originally was going to talk about that really there's a difference here in between the advocates of this ruling and the critics of this ruling, and that the advocates are trying to ensure that it's both protect against future harm as well as correct, or I don't want to say punish, but, you know, correct through fines and whatever those people that are in violation of the laws, whereas the other side is simply a correction side. We'll find somebody once we've proven that there's a problem. Well, by then there's a problem. But what he just said about how the law works and regulations work when it comes to environmental regulation is they are not in the business of regulating cows, numbers of cows. They're in the business of regulating the capacity of, or the farmers, have they demonstrated that they have the capacity to deal with the waste.
I take your point. We're just about out of time, but Mike making the point there, Scott, that a permit could require, if you have so many cows, here are the steps you have to take to prevent environmental damage. Just in our last minute, can you respond to that?
Well, that was the law even before this. I mean, basically right now, if you're a CAFO, if you have 1,000 animal units or more, you have to do all of these environmental regulations that other farms are not required to do. But this Supreme Court decision says the DNR can actually limit how many cows you can have. I'm not sure if the caller understood that precisely, but that is what the Supreme Court said. And again, I'll go back to the farms that have the financial resources to really manage manure and animal waste are the larger farms. And this decision is going to make it harder for larger farms to even exist at all. And so we'll have, you know, potentially more farms staying as small farms, almost completely unregulated. And that's not good for water quality.
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Scott Manley, Executive Vice President of Government Relations for Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. Earlier, we heard from Evan Feinauer from Clean Wisconsin, both of them with us to look at two new state Supreme Court decisions on the DNR and water quality. Coming up after the news, dads have a tough time taking advantage of family leave, even when it's available. We'll find out why and look at solutions. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, once upon a time, if you wanted to do some banking, you had to go to the bank. Then came ATMs. Now there's an app for that, and more innovations are on the way. Explore the world of neo-banking and what it means for you and your money. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, in the U.S. and many countries around the world, new fathers often have a difficult time taking paternity leave, even when paid leave is available. There are cultural norms about whose job it is to take care of a young child, and many men say they worry that taking paternity leave could hurt their career prospects. Our next guest recently wrote about new research that takes a closer look at that last point and that could shine a light on how to make paternity leave more common. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a dad who's taken or not taken paternity leave? What influenced your decision either way? How do you feel about the decision now? For anyone, why do you think it's important to encourage dads to take paternity leave? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Seema Jayachandran is an economics professor at Northwestern University. She wrote a piece on this topic for the New York Times. Seema, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. It's nice to be with you.
We'll get into the research you wrote about in just a minute. But first of all, big picture, how does the U.S. compare to some other so-called developed countries when it comes to paid time off for new dads?
the U.S. is definitely behind most of the other rich countries in the world in not having paid paternity leave for men. Some U.S. states, a handful of states, offer it, but at the federal level, we don't offer it, and that makes us stick out.
Okay, that's one piece of the puzzle, but as you write, and some other people have found this too, even when it is available, this paid paternity leave, men don't necessarily leap at the opportunity to take it. How common is that?
Yeah, no, it's very common. And that's why I wrote the piece that there's increasing discussion about having paid paternity leave at the federal level. But that's just one piece of the puzzle. We also need to make sure men take it. So, for example, in California, which was the first state to offer it, men take on average 5 days of paternity leave, whereas women take 6 weeks. So a lot of men don't take it. And when they take it, they just take a couple of days. And why is that? You know, it's what you said at the outset, that many are afraid that it will hurt their careers. They sort of wish they could take it, or not everyone, but a lot of them would want to take it. And there's a lot of research showing that it's really beneficial for the entire family if they do. But you know, the challenge is to how do we get to a world in which men feel comfortable taking that paternity leave?
Talking to Seema Jayachandran from Northwestern University, economics professor there, looking at paternity leave for new dads and why even when it's available, even when it's paid, they may be reluctant to take it. Why do you think that might be? 800-642-1234 to share your answer to that question. Maybe your own experience in your family. 800-642-1234. Seema, take us to Norway now, please, because that looks like a pretty good place to study this kind of stuff, as you write.
Yeah, so some of the best evidence we have on what happens when men take paternity leave is from Norway, partly because it's more generous there. But they also had a big change in 1993, where they went from some optional paternity leave for men, where either the mother or the father could use it, to use it or lose it 4 weeks for the dad. And that made a big difference. There's a big jump in the number of dads who took it. And that's useful for researchers because they can compare the dads who were in the world who had kids when the policy was generous versus when it wasn't. And unfortunately, that research confirms what men fear, that there is an earnings loss when they take paternity leave. And that's puzzling because, you know, the 4 weeks is not a lot of time. So one of the reasons, say, when you might think you have an earnings hit is because you forgot things, you know, your skills became rusty when you were away, but this is only 4 weeks. And so there's a new study that I thought was worth highlighting that does something quite clever. They looked at whether a man went on paternity leave and his competitors at work were going on leave at the same time. So other men in his group who were about his same stage in his career, did they go ahead and take paternity leave? And what they found was that men's earnings are only hurt if their competitors at work don't take leave. If everybody in sync was taking paternity leave, then there's no career hit. And so that's, you know, that's kind of interesting because you have to then say, what is the explanation for why what other people are doing affects whether I'm affected if I take leave? And, you know, one explanation would be stigma, that there's some sort of stigma, and if we all did it, then the stigma would go away. I think that is a factor, certainly in the U.S. and probably in Norway. In this case, it really mattered whether it was your very close competitor. So it's really an issue of, you know, you're just away from the office for a few days, a few weeks, and you miss out on the deal flow when there's a new opportunity, or maybe the boss is thinking about who's doing well. And that small difference can tip who gets promoted, you know, if there's an opening for a management position. And so strangely, these small differences, it's not that you're really less productive to your company. It's just that we've created a culture in many offices where if you're away for a couple of days, then that could set you back. And so kind of the why I think that's important is the logic of it would say that, you know, if we can only get all men to take paternity leave, then the downside for any one of them would evaporate. So we're in this world where many men would like to be taking it, but they're afraid to take it. If we can get them to coordinate and all take it, it would be more, they'd be happier to have more time with their families, and they wouldn't have a career penalty from it anymore.
So what's going on? If I'm a guy and I take this family leave, then the vultures at my office are swooping in and grabbing that promotion while I'm looking the other way. That's basically what's happening, or maybe happening here.
Yeah. And that makes it sound so.
I hate those guys.
Yeah, no, exactly. It sounds so cutthroat, and we don't think, you know, who we like our colleagues. They're not our competitors, but unfortunately there is something zero sum in workplaces. I think a promotion is a good example where you have two people, you know, they're collaborating, but there's a pyramid at work and there's only one opening to move up and become a more senior position. And so that other person doesn't necessarily have to be gunning it to try to, you know, being gleeful about taking a promotion away from you, but just by being there more days of the week, they're have more face time with the boss, and that might put them over the top. And so it's sort of a shame that this small, what seems like a small difference of like being away for 2 weeks or 3 weeks can magnify into something that, you know, can last, can affect careers, you know, 5-6 years later. And you know, but unfortunately we sometimes we're collaborating with people, but sometimes there isn't room for everybody to move up the ranks. And so one of the interesting, you know, findings is that when companies are fast growing, then you, just in general, there seems to be less of an earnings hit for men who take leave. You know, so the in the sense that in say a fast growing tech company, it's growing so fast that everybody can get promoted. You know, it's just hiring and hiring and hiring. So in those cases, you actually don't see some of the same patterns that you see in the rest of the economy. So I don't think the lesson is, you know, we need to kind of make all companies be growing 20% a year, but I think we need to think about how can we shift to this world where everyone's taking paternity leave and therefore the fears men have become obsolete.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234 with her thoughts on this issue and maybe experiences too. Let's go to Ben in La Crosse. Ben, hi.
Hi. So I had the opportunity, I have a 6-month-old now, and I had the opportunity to take paternity leave, which my fiance ended up going through some postpartum, that having me being able to be there to take up that slack to ease things for was such a big help for us. That, yeah, it was one of those shorter, it was 4 weeks, but it made a world of difference for us. And, you know, that mental health side, not just for me to have that bonding time, but for her was just immeasurably helpful.
Well, Ben, two things. A, congratulations. And B, did you feel this worry that we're hearing about that it might set your career back a little bit if you're out of time? Somebody else is going to get, I don't know, the raise or the what opportunity or whatever. Or you didn't feel like you were looking at over your shoulder. What do you think?
In the field that I'm working in, which I'm a radiologic technologist, it's a group thing that I never felt anything like that, but there was no promotion up at the time or anything like that for like their lead tech. So there was no concern of that. I didn't feel.
Awesome. Ben, thank you so much for sharing that story. And Seema, we heard about the value, the emotional value that Ben saw in having that opportunity, something you referred to right at the outset.
Yeah, no, exactly. There are so many benefits to men, to children, to their wives or partners from taking paternity leave. Ben talked about one, and there's actually research showing that in Sweden, that women's health is better if their partner was eligible for paternity leave, you know, for postpartum depression, even infections. Like, so someone's noticing that you have a health problem, making sure you get the help you need, whether that's postpartum depression or physical health. So just on that very basics of women's recovery from childbirth. But there are also longer term benefits of Ben mentioned bonding. You know, years later, kids and dads report having closer relationships. It equalizes the division of labor at home. So it helps women's careers if the fathers have taken on a bigger role at home. So there's just a lot of evidence that, you know, consistent with Ben's experience, that this is good for the entire family.
Thanks for calling in, Ben. We're talking to Seema Jayachandran. She's an economics professor at Northwestern University. She's with us today to talk about how to get more men in the U.S. to take paternity leave. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts on this, maybe your own experience. Have you been able to take family leave as a new dad? Was it difficult for you? Maybe it wasn't paid, so it wasn't even on the table for you. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about paternity leave and why many fathers don't take it even when paid time off is available. Seema Jayachandran is with us from Northwestern University, and you can join in with your questions, thoughts, and or experiences at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. John is with us in Monroe. John, hi.
Hi, guys. I was just calling to give my experience. The previous caller answered part of a question that I had. My experience, I did have it offered. I did take advantage of it. It lasted about a week, and, you know, that was long enough to, we had two normal, healthy children, normal births. So I was off about a week and, helped my wife get settled and everything at home. And then, you know, the last few days, I found, boredom setting in, and I was very ready to go back to work. And so I was kind of going to ask what would a man do, for 6 or 12 weeks, or whatever normal paternity leave would be. For that entire duration, because I really, you know, my wife kind of took care of the baby for the most part. I might have took a night shift or something here or there, but I didn't feel like it was a two-person job and was bored and very ready to go back to work after a week. So,
John, thanks for the call. Seema, one perspective there, antsiness to get back to work is driving at least one guy to be done with leave.
Yeah, no, and I think probably we will never reach a stage where men take as much family leave as women do. But I think some of the, you know, kind of longer paternity leaves create a shift in that, those roles at home. So if it's usually the mom who's taking care of the kid, you know, obviously there are certain things like breastfeeding that women are going to do, but things like the diaper changes or kind of night duty. One of the things that happens with the longer leaves is those roles become more equal, and it maybe takes a few weeks to get into that habit. So it really becomes a normal routine. And what the research has found is that that has a long lasting effect. So it's not just during that, you know, say 4 weeks of paternity leave, it's even several years later that has just made it so that, you know, changing the kids or bathing the kids is becomes more of an equal role between, dads and moms. And so that's a, you know, it's a mindset shift. It's basically a change in the norm about who has the primary childcare responsibilities. And so the interesting thing is that paternity leave can be the impetus to create those broader changes in norms about men's role in raising their children.
John, thanks for that call. We'll go to Tim now in St. Germain. Tim, hello.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to let you know about my experience. It's not quite the same because it wasn't paternity leave, but it was leave for coronavirus. So it was the family leave. And what happened to me was I took the leave, and when it was time to come back, the company I worked for decided that, well, we were just going to lay you off now because you took the leave and you were the only one that took the leave. So,
well, I'm sorry to hear that, Tim. Sorry about that experience. And for the family leave, Seema, I think that's got to be a nagging fear for a lot of men and women in the workforce that if I take this long leave, did I just demonstrate to my employer that they can live without me?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly what's holding a lot of men back, that the, you know, it's not just what I was mentioning earlier of you're not in the deal flow when there's a promotion opening. You're worried about what it's signaling to your employers about your commitment. And so it's, you know, kind of any man on his own, these fears are unfortunately rational. And the key is what kind of policies can the government put in place or can companies put in place so that that fear goes away, that, you know, it's not signaling something. It's so normal that why would you punish a man for taking a few weeks of paternity leave, it's if you had to fire all of them, you would have to fire your entire workforce. So if we got to, 100% or 90% take up, then it wouldn't be a viable, kind of response for a company to say, I'm going to fire that guy for taking paternity leave. And so I think that, raises an interesting question of how do you switch this norm? And so I think you've seen some demonstration of CEOs of companies doing it to kind of set an example. So Alexis Ohanian at Reddit and Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook, they took several months of paternity leave. Obviously, they can financially afford it, but I think part of what they were trying to do is kind of set an example so that more of their employees would feel comfortable to do it. And, you hope that it snowballs and then you go from it becoming the exception to becoming the rule that a month of paternity leave is totally normal.
Thanks for the call, Tim. Again, sorry to hear that happen to you. We're talking to Seema Jayachandran from Northwestern University, economics professor there, looking at paternity leave. Even when paid leave is available, a lot of guys don't take it. Talking about some of the reasons why. And Seema, something that's nagging at me through this whole discussion is, okay, if the guy who takes paternity leave is seeing sort of an opportunity cost, a missed opportunity maybe for promotion or whatever that hurts them in the long term, what about women who are already taking longer leave? What's that doing to them?
Yeah, no, I think that is exactly, some of the same things are happening, and women's leaves are longer. So some of it isn't just this, competition in the workplace. It's that women, if you're out of the labor market for a year or 6 months, maybe some of your skills aren't as sharp when you come back. But, the strange irony is that when you make family leave eligible for men and women, and only women take it up, so take the states like California where women take 6 weeks and men take a few days, that can actually hurt the gender gaps in the labor market, because now women are away and all of the things that you worry about that employers are punishing you, they happen exclusively to women and not to many men because they didn't take the leave. So one of the reasons to encourage paternity leave is to try to equalize things in the workplace so women aren't as disadvantaged. So, I think that we would hope in some cases being eligible for generous maternity leave enables a woman to stay in the labor market, it allowed her to not make a trade-off and she could take time off and go back to work. But sometimes it can actually do the opposite. It could sort of hurt women's careers because it's just hardening these gender roles where, okay, so if the woman took leave and the man didn't, now it just becomes more of her specialty to do childcare. So we saw this in the pandemic that women were out of the labor market much more. The unemployment spike was much more true for women because women took on that childcare role and it was hard to have two parents working full time and having children at home. So part of the push for why I think it would be great to have more paternity leave is exactly because women suffer some of the same downsides we've been talking about, and that gap wouldn't be as big if paternity leave became more common.
And briefly, as you wrap up, Seema, a federal policy like Norway's might be a long way off. Do you see companies maybe taking the lead on this more and more and instituting their own policies on paternity leave?
Yeah, President Biden has proposed in his American Families Plan 12 weeks of paternity leave and maternity leave, paid leave, not at the 100% replacement rate of your salary like in Norway, but, at two-thirds or something like that. So we'll see, if that comes about in the U.S. But in the meantime, several companies are offering paid paternity leave. They're the exception rather than the rule. And I think, I think there are lots of reasons you would benefit as a company from having offering a benefit that your employees like. You can attract more people, but it's also hard if you think, okay, I'm going to lose my employees for a few weeks and my competitors aren't. So I think this is a case where the best approach is for states, like this, more state legislatures to take this on, or ideally federal policy.
Seema, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
That's Seema Jayachandran. She's an economics professor at Northwestern University, joining us for a look at paid family leave for new dads. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the U.S. ranks very low when it comes to trust in media compared to other rich countries. We'll look at the causes and possible solutions to the problem. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. got a couple of messages from listeners over the last few days saying that they could hear our Ideas Network radio signal. Well, that's not too weird. That's the goal, that people can hear what we're saying here. The weird part is where we heard from. This comes from our audience services department. They told us that a listener in Connecticut, yes, the state, called in and says he's picking up the Larry Mueller Show when tuning into 91.3 where he's located. And we got an email from Nashville, Tennessee, saying they're getting an Ideas Network signal. Not just any signal, KUWS 91.3 in Superior, about as far away from Nashville as you can get here in Wisconsin. That's just under 800 miles as the crow flies, and it's at least 500 miles from anywhere in Wisconsin to anywhere in Connecticut. What's going on? I don't know. I've heard that in the right weather and atmospheric conditions, radio signals can bounce a long way. So Wisconsin signals might be picked up on the other side of Lake Michigan, for example. That's one idea. Another idea, at least one of these incidents involved Larry Mueller, and he's got a really big voice. So maybe it's just carrying that far. Or three, it's something else. I want to hear from you. If you're picking up our signal from a long way away, let us know. Let's be clear. I mean, a broadcast signal on your radio. If you're listening online, that's cool. Not a mystery. Email where you hear us. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or just yell really loud. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.